if you completely stopped immigration tomorrow, I mean, the American economy wouldn't just stabilize into some, predictable, manageable state. It would completely stall out.
Yeah, it would basically hit a brick wall.
Exactly. And that is the baseline reality we are starting with today. Welcome to this deep dive, where we are looking at this incredibly complex topic. And, if you look at decades of National Academies of Sciences reports, Federal Reserve analyses, and NBER papers, that whole traditional narrative of immigration just being a simple cost-benefit ledger, it completely falls apart.
It really does. It's way too simplistic.
Right. And I want to set some ground rules for you right off the bat. We aren't looking at this through a political lens today at all.
Right, no politics.
None. There is so much emotionally charged noise out there, but we are pushing all of that aside. Today, we have a massive stack of scholarly research, historical case studies, and hard economic data to answer one fundamentally mechanical question.
Which is basically what actually happens to a society's economy, its labor market, and its physical communities when immigrants arrive.
Exactly. So, to really get to the bottom of that question, we kind of have to throw out the most common metaphor people use for the economy.
Yeah, the container metaphor.
Right, the container. Explain that framework for us.
So we tend to picture the economy as a fixed container. Like, imagine a glass of water that's already full to the brim.
Okay.
In that mindset, if you pour more water into the glass, I mean, it obviously overflows. Someone inevitably gets displaced.
Because there's only so much room.
Right, exactly. But the empirical evidence from, well, basically the past century shows that an economy is not a fixed container at all. It behaves much more like a complex biological ecosystem.
An ecosystem. Okay, so how does that change the dynamic?
Well, when you introduce a new element or like a new species into that environment, it doesn't just eat the existing resources and push others out. It actually alters the soil composition, you know? It changes the canopy. It fundamentally expands the size and the carrying capacity of the entire forest.
So we are looking at an ecosystem that is actively expanding and like reorganizing itself constantly.
Yes, exactly.
Let's start right at the forest floor then, with the labor market. Because the most persistent assumption out there, and I hear this all the time, is the zero-sum model.
Oh, yeah, it's the oldest assumption in the book.
Right. The idea is strictly mathematical, right? If you add more workers to the labor pool, labor becomes cheaper, and the native-born workers either lose their jobs or they see their wages permanently depressed.
And, you know, the supply and demand intuition there seems incredibly straightforward.
Sure. Supply goes up, price goes down.
Right. But when you actually look at the major National Academies report or the extensive modeling by economists like Giovanni Perry and Rachel Friedberg, the conventional wisdom is largely contradicted.
Really? Contradicted how?
Well, the negative impacts on native-born wages are actually extremely small. And over the long run, the overall effect on native-born wages and employment is actually positive.
Wait, hold on. Adding a massive influx of labor leads to a positive or even a neutral effect on existing workers' wages. That's completely counterintuitive.
I know it sounds totally backwards.
If the supply of workers goes up, the price of labor, the wages, should go down. Why doesn't it?
Because we're assuming all labor is identical, and it's not.
Okay, unpack that for me.
Economists call the mechanism driving this task specialization. The core finding in Giovanni Perry's work is that less educated immigrants and native-born workers, they generally do not compete for the exact same jobs.
Oh, they don't.
No, they don't substitute for one another. They actually complement each other. They specialize.
Okay, let's track a specific industry to see how that actually functions on the ground. Like if we look at construction or hospitality, how does that complementarity play out?
Let's take the restaurant industry as a microcosm. I think it makes it really clear.
Okay, picture an economy as a restaurant. I like it.
Right. So when immigrant workers arrive, especially those who are maybe newer to the country and perhaps less fluent in the local language, they tend to specialize in manual routine or, you know, physically intensive tasks.
So they are taking the back-of-house jobs, the prep cooks, dishwashers, line cooks.
Exactly. Meanwhile, native-born workers have a comparative advantage in communication-intensive tasks, things like management and just localized knowledge of how things work in that specific town.
So the existing worker gets bumped up, not out.
Right. Because the restaurant can now process food faster and serve more tables, they need more managers. So the native-born worker who speaks fluent English and understands the local clientele, they shift into a higher-paying front-of-house management role or maybe a head server position.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. The immigrant doesn't just fill a static job. Their actual presence changes how the work is organized.
Precisely. The restaurant expands, overall productivity goes up, and that structural shift literally pushes the native-born worker up the skill ladder.
And there's data backing up this specific shift.
Oh, definitely. The American Economic Journal published research tracking exactly this dynamic. Downward wage pressure is significantly mitigated because native-born workers pivot toward those communication-intensive jobs.
The ecosystem reorganizes.
Exactly. It's a reorganization, not a displacement.
But, okay, to be fair to the listener, the data isn't universally just this magic upward escalator for every single person, right?
No, no, it's not. It's definitely more nuanced than that.
Because George J. Borchus has a pretty large body of work at the National Bureau of Economic Research, the NBER. That paints a more complicated picture about how those economic gains are actually distributed.
Yes, Borchus is very important to mention here. He emphasizes a really crucial distinction between total economic growth and per capita income effects.
Right, distinguishing between the total pie and the individual slice.
Exactly. Immigrants unequivocally add to the total economic output. Like, the total gross domestic product expands. There is no real debate there. But we have to look at specific subgroups of workers. Native-born workers who do not have a high school diploma and who are directly competing for those manual physical tasks, they can experience short-term wage friction.
Because they don't have the educational leverage to seamlessly transition into those communication-intensive management roles we just talked about.
Right. The pie gets bigger, but their specific slice of it might face downward pressure because they are in direct competition for those very specific foundational tasks. We have to be honest about that friction.
Yeah, that friction is very real. But even looking at that specific demographic, I was reading newer NBER papers from 2024 by Kayumi and Perry, and they estimate that from 2000 to 2019, the wage effects were actually positive even for less educated native-born workers.
Yeah, which is fascinating.
Right. The overall expansion of the economy ended up lifting the floor for pretty much everyone over that two-decade span.
It did. And that's largely because of massive macroeconomic factors that the Federal Reserve has been tracking really intensely.
The macro view. Let's get into that. What is the Fed seeing?
Well, you have to look at the demographic reality of the United States. Analyses from the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco and the Kansas City Fed, they point to this looming demographic cliff.
The aging population.
Yes. The baby boomers are retiring in massive, massive numbers right now. And the native-born birth rate is currently below replacement level.
So without immigrants, the so-called prime-age labor force just naturally shrinks.
It shrinks drastically. And when the labor force shrinks, businesses literally cannot expand. Production slows down.
And you risk falling into a stagnant economy like we've seen in parts of Western Europe and Japan, where they're really struggling with aging populations.
Exactly. Immigrants are maintaining the break-even employment growth that is absolutely necessary just to keep the entire economy stable. They are the demographic backstop.
Wow, the demographic backstop. Mm-hmm. So we've seen how immigrant labor fills out the foundation of the workforce, reorganizing the bottom and pushing native workers into different roles. But if they're reorganizing the bottom, who is building the top?
That is a great question.
Because it's not just prep cooks and dishwashers. Let's look at the patent offices and the executive suites. The American Immigration Council recently released a report looking at the Fortune 500 companies projected for 2025.
The numbers in that report are just staggering.
They really are. 231 of those Fortune 500 companies were founded by immigrants or their children.
Which is almost half.
Right. Nearly half of the largest corporations driving the American economy. How does that happen? What's the mechanism behind that specific number?
The mechanism there is actually deeply tied to the psychology and the sociology of migration itself.
Oh, really? How so?
Think about it. Moving to a completely new country, often with very limited resources, sometimes not speaking the language, and having no established network that requires a massive, massive baseline tolerance for risk.
Well, that makes sense. You have to be incredibly brave or incredibly tolerant of uncertainty.
Exactly. And that exact same risk tolerance correlates directly with entrepreneurial risk taking.
So it's like a natural selection mechanism. The people willing to uproot their entire lives physically are the exact same people willing to risk starting a company from scratch.
Yes. And we have over a century of historical data proving this isn't just like a modern Silicon Valley tech boom phenomenon.
It goes back way further.
Way further. There's a major study by Conrad Bertardi and his colleagues, and they analyzed 130 years of county-level data across the U.S.
130 years. That's a huge data set.
It's massive. They tracked historical settlement patterns and found a definitive positive causal effect.
Meaning what exactly for those local counties?
It means the counties that received more immigrants in the 19th and early 20th centuries actually saw higher rates of innovation, they filed more patents, and they exhibited greater economic dynamism that lasted for generations.
Generations.
Ah.
So the initial injection of human capital just compounded over decades.
It compounded beautifully.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting to me. I get that a highly skilled immigrant might invent something great, right? They're smart, they take risks. But the research from the Journal of Economic Geography goes even further.
The diversity spillovers.
Yes, the diversity spillovers. The research suggests that cultural diversity and immigrant presence literally alter a native-born inventor's output. It makes the native workers around them more productive.
Yeah, they make everyone else better.
How does that spillover actually work on a mechanical level? Because it sounds almost like magic.
It's not magic. It actually comes down to the mechanics of collaboration and cognitive toolkits.
Cognitive toolkits. Okay, explain that.
So think about how a really difficult problem is solved, maybe in a biochemistry lab or an advanced engineering firm. If everyone in that room has the exact same educational background, the same cultural references, and the exact same problem-solving frameworks,
they will likely hit a wall at the exact same time.
Precisely. They share the same blind spots. They exhaust their shared toolkit simultaneously. Oh, wow. I never thought about it like that.
Right. But studies by researchers like Christine Wigger and Neil Lee, they show that high-skilled immigrants bring totally different cognitive frameworks.
Because they learn to think about problems differently.
Exactly. They structure hypotheses differently. They have different global networks to draw upon. And they approach risk and failure from very different cultural standpoints.
So they introduce a new tool to the lab.
Yes. The National Bureau of Economic Research published a paper by Shai Bernstein showing that immigrant inventors generate direct patent output themselves, obviously, but they also generate measurable productivity spillovers for their U.S.-born collaborators.
So the native-born workers literally produce more and better patents just because they are synthesizing ideas within diverse teams. They are unlocking new ways of thinking for the native-born inventor.
Exactly. The cross-pollination of ideas is what drives the innovation.
And we actually have a historical test case for what happens if you decide to restrict that specific talent pool, don't we? We do.
Yeah.
And it's a really stark example. It's a brilliant piece of historical research from 2026 by B. Cornejo Costas.
Okay, what do they look at?
They look back at the 1920s U.S. immigration quotas, specifically the 1924 Johnson-Reed Act.
Right, which severely restricted immigration from Southern and Eastern Europe, if I remember correctly.
Exactly. It essentially cut off a massive flow of international talent overnight. So this study tracked the patenting data in the specific geographical areas and the technological fields that were most reliant on those immigrant populations.
So they looked at what happens when you suddenly turn off the tap. What happened to the patent output?
Innovation measurably fell. I mean, you can literally track the loss of American innovation on a graph.
It just dropped off.
Yes. The areas hit hardest by those quotas saw a sharp decline in patent filings compared to areas that were less affected.
And crucially, it wasn't just immigrant patents that vanished.
Right,
because there were fewer immigrants.
Right, that's the key part. The native-born patenting rate in those specific fields dropped as well.
Because the collaborative spillovers disappeared.
Exactly. Because you remove the diverse cognitive toolkits, the native-born inventors hit those walls we talked about earlier. Turning off the tap of human capital literally shrank the entire innovation ecosystem.
That is fascinating.
Yes.
And that actually transitions us perfectly from, you know, the soaring heights of Fortune 500s and patent law to the gritty everyday reality of paying for it all.
Ah, yes. The fiscal ledger.
Right. Taxes and public budgets.
Yeah.
Because this is where the public perception and the actual economic data often violently collide.
They really do. It's probably the most hotly debated aspect.
So let's just lay it out for the listener, unpacking the fiscal impact. Do immigrants cost more in public services than they pay into the system?
Well, to answer that, we really have to look at the hard numbers regarding tax contributions.
Okay, let's hear the numbers.
The Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy estimates that undocumented immigrants alone, just the undocumented population, paid nearly $97 billion in U.S. taxes in 2022.
Wait, hold on. $97 billion from the undocumented population alone?
Yep. Nearly $100 billion.
How are they paying that much if they aren't fully integrated into the formal legal system? I think a lot of people assume they just work under the table and don't pay taxes.
It's a huge misconception. They pay through a combination of things. First, sales taxes on literally everything they purchase in their daily lives.
Like everyone pays sales tax at the register.
Exactly. Then there's property taxes. They pay these either directly as homeowners or indirectly through rent that gets passed down by their landlords.
Because the landlord uses the rent to pay the property tax.
Got it.
Right. And then, crucially, payroll taxes.
How do they pay payroll taxes?
Well, millions of undocumented workers use individual taxpayer identification numbers, or ITNs, to file their taxes officially. And millions of others have payroll taxes automatically deducted from their paychecks by their employers.
And those payroll taxes fund things like Social Security and Medicare.
Exactly. Programs that they themselves, by law, largely cannot access or draw from. Wow. So they are paying into a safety net that they can't even use. The Center for Migration Studies completely corroborates that immense payroll tax contribution, by the way.
It's a massive net positive for those federal trust funds.
But to understand the true fiscal ledger, we really have to look beyond just a single year's tax return, right? We have to look at the timeline.
Yes. James P. Smith's research is absolutely critical here.
What does Smith's research highlight?
It highlights a massive generational shift. You really have to separate the short-term costs of the first generation from the long-term gains of the second generation.
Okay, break that down for us. What happens with the first generation?
The first generation of immigrants, particularly those arriving with maybe less formal education, they might have lower initial earnings, and they do require immediate public investments.
Like what?
Most notably, public education for their children. That's a big one. And English language programs, emergency health care, things like that.
So just to be totally clear and balanced here, they are a net cost in the immediate term from a purely fiscal standpoint.
Often, yes. The initial integration phase costs money. But then you look at the second generation, the children of those immigrants.
And what happens with them?
They are historically among the strongest economic contributors in the entire country.
Really? The second generation outpaces the norm.
By a lot. They achieve higher levels of education, they earn significantly higher wages, and over their lifetimes, they pay far more in taxes than their parents ever cost the system initially.
So when you run the calculus on the long-term multi-generational impact, the fiscal contribution is overwhelmingly positive.
Overwhelmingly. It's a huge return on the initial investment.
Okay, but let me push back on this, or at least play devil's advocate for a listener who might be wondering.
Sure.
If undocumented immigrants are injecting $97 billion into the system, and the second generation yields these massive economic returns, why is my local mayor on the news every night saying the city's going bankrupt? You know, they're saying they can't afford to house or educate new arrivals. The city budgets are strained. Those two realities, the soaring national GDP and the struggling local mayor, they don't seem to match up.
They don't match up because of what the National Academies report identifies as a structural mismatch in government funding.
A structural mismatch?
Yes, and it is perhaps the single most misunderstood mechanism in the entire economics of immigration.
Okay, explain the structural mismatch to us. Where is all this money actually going?
Okay, so when immigrants arrive, work, and spend money, they generate massive economic activity, right?
Right.
They pay federal income taxes and federal payroll taxes. The vast majority of those tax revenues flow upward straight to Washington, D.C.
Okay, so the federal government gets the bulk of the cash.
Exactly. The federal government reaps the fiscal reward of that economic growth. However, the immediate costs of integration, we're talking about hiring ESL teachers for the local public schools, providing emergency health care at the county hospital, maintaining local roads, expanding local infrastructure.
Those costs fall squarely on the budgets of state and local governments.
Precisely. The federal government cashes the check, but the local mayor gets the bill.
Oh, wow. The federal government cashes the check, but the local mayor gets the bill. That is incredibly stark.
The Brookings Institution has detailed this extensively. The long-term national fiscal impact is highly positive. But the short-term local burden is a very, very real friction point.
Because the tax system doesn't equitably distribute the revenue generated by immigrants back down to the local communities.
Right. The communities that are bearing the upfront costs of integrating them are left holding the bag.
So when local mayors sound the alarm about their budgets, they aren't just making it up. They are experiencing a real policy failure.
Exactly. They aren't wrong about their localized spreadsheets. The math in their town is red. but it requires an equitable revenue-sharing policy solution between the federal and local levels.
Right. It requires fixing the plumbing of the tax system, not just economic hand-waving that ignores the total national gain.
Exactly. You can't just tell a mayor GDP is up when they can't afford to pay teachers.
That structural mismatch perfectly explains the disconnect. And, you know, mentioning local infrastructure and local budgets, that naturally bridges our conversation from these abstract tax dollars to the physical communities where people actually live.
Right, the social infrastructure.
Exactly. Specifically, our healthcare system and rural America. Let's start with healthcare, because the economy isn't just businesses. It's made up of people needing care.
And as we discussed with the demographic cliff, we have a lot of people needing care right now.
Right. There's a fascinating NBER study by David Grabowski and his co-authors from 2026 that looks specifically at older adult mortality.
This is such an important study because as the American population ages so rapidly, the demand for home health aides, nursing home staff, and direct care workers is just skyrocketing.
And these are incredibly physically demanding, emotionally taxing jobs, right? Often with very high turnover.
Very high. The Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City actually highlighted this in a bulletin recently, questioning whether the healthcare labor supply can possibly keep up with this aging-driven demand.
And what did the NBER study show?
It showed that immigrants are incredibly heavily represented in this direct long-term care support.
They're essentially the backbone of the sector.
They absolutely are. And the study implies that an increased supply of immigrant care workers directly correlates to improved access to care and literally lower mortality rates for elderly Americans.
Wow. Lower mortality rates. So the labor supply isn't just some abstract economic metric on a spreadsheet here. It is literally keeping the aging U.S. population safe and alive.
Yes. It is life or death infrastructure.
That's incredible. We also see this dynamic of long-term community contribution when we look at refugee integration, right?
Yes, definitely.
Obviously, the humanitarian aspect of accepting refugees is well known. We all understand that. But purely economically, research by William Evans and Daniel Fitzgerald looked at the outcomes using American Community Survey data. What did they find?
Well, obviously, refugees have high initial resettlement costs. They often arrive fleeing conflict with absolutely nothing.
Right. They require immediate housing, medical care, intensive language support.
Exactly. But Evans and Fitzgerald found that over the long term, refugees integrate into the workforce and contribute significantly more in taxes than they receive in that initial relocation assistance.
So again, it's an initial cost with a long-term return. And the speed of that economic integration can actually be engineered, can't it?
It can. It doesn't have to be a slow process.
There are these community sponsorship models. I was reading an article from The Guardian about how they do this in Australia, and there are reports from HIS in the U.S. where local volunteer groups basically sponsor a refugee family directly.
Yes, the sponsorship model is incredibly effective.
How does it work?
When communities take an active role in integration, meaning everyday people are helping newcomers secure housing, helping them navigate complex employment pathways, practicing the language with them.
Taking them to the DMV, showing them how the grocery store works.
Exactly. When that happens, the economic and social integration happens much, much faster. It breaks down the isolation that can often trap new arrivals in poverty.
It turns newcomers into active taxpayers and community members rapidly.
Right. It's a structured support system that yields huge economic dividends for the town.
Which brings us to some of the most compelling case studies in the source material. We're talking about regional revitalization in the Rust Belt and in rural America.
Yeah, these are places that have been hemorrhaging population for decades, basically, as young people move away to major cities.
Right. The sources mention towns like Worthington, Minnesota, and Charleroi, Pennsylvania.
The American Immigration Council and the Center for American Progress have published really extensive reports on this exact dynamic. In the Great Lakes region and throughout the Midwest, immigrants are basically the primary force offsetting population decline.
Let's dive deep into that Worthington, Minnesota case study from the Associated Press, because I think it perfectly encapsulates this entire ecosystem we've been talking about.
It's a perfect microcosm, yeah.
What does a town like Worthington look like before this influx of immigrants?
Before the demographic shift, Worthington, like so many rural towns, was facing a very slow economic death.
The population was aging out.
Aging out, the tax base was shrinking. And the main economic engine of the town, which in Worthington's case is a massive meatpacking plant, it was really struggling to find enough labor just to keep its lines running.
And if that plant closes?
If the plant closes, the secondary businesses fail, the local schools lose their funding, and the town essentially just boards up, it dies.
Then the immigrant population arrives.
Right. They arrive to staff the plant.
So they keep the plant running,
right,
which saves the primary tax base of the town.
They do. But it goes so much further beyond the factory floor. They create what economists call business dynamism.
What does that look like on Main Street?
It looks like people opening small businesses. Grocery stores, restaurants, salons, and downtown storefronts that had literally been empty for years. They buy homes, which stabilizes the local real estate market. They bring young families, which keeps the local school districts funded and open because there are finally kids in the classrooms again.
So it's an economic salvation on paper. But practically speaking, you know, a small town in Minnesota suddenly seeing a massive demographic, linguistic, and cultural shift, they must face immense growing pains.
Oh, absolutely.
How does a town actually navigate that friction? Because the research has to weigh the economic salvation against the social friction of integration.
The AP reporting gives a very clear-eyed, honest picture of that friction. The economic benefits are undeniable, but the social challenges stress the local systems heavily.
Like the structural mismatch we talked about earlier.
Exactly. The local school district suddenly has to hire ESL teachers to navigate dozens of new languages. The local hospital has to provide translation services on the fly.
And there are real tensions, I imagine, around building a shared community identity.
Very real tensions. You have longtime residents and newcomers who have completely different cultural practices trying to share the same small town.
It's a messy reality on the ground. Like you said, the ecosystem is expanding, but the soil is being disrupted.
It is a messy two-way street of integration. But, and this is crucial, we have to view this through a historical lens.
Okay, take us back.
If we look at research by Suku Kim on the American Industrial Revolution, or you look at the Library of Congress archives on the Gilded Age, we see that this exact friction has happened before, continuously.
You're talking about when immigrants from Scandinavia, Italy, and Eastern Europe flooded into American industrial towns in the late 19th century.
Precisely. There was immense social tension back then, too. Severe language barriers, huge political pushback. It wasn't smooth.
Right.
But historically, this messy, uncomfortable integration is a recurring, highly successful pattern in American history. It takes a generation, but the result is sustained economic growth and community renewal.
So Worthington is just experiencing the 21st century version of the exact same historical cycle.
Exactly. It's the same engine, just a different era.
Okay, so we've established that immigrants are doing everything from preventing rural towns from going bankrupt to staffing the elder care facilities to inventing the next wave of Fortune 500 technology.
Right, they are woven into every level.
But what happens if you throw the engine in reverse?
That is the million-dollar question.
The sources from 2025 and 2026 detail significant macroeconomic fallout from recent ICE enforcement surges, mass deportations, and suddenly declining immigration levels.
Yeah, the data from the last couple of years provides a pretty grim natural experiment. Reports from the Brookings Institution, the Urban Institute, and the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco have studied the economic shockwaves of mass enforcement and a sudden drop in immigrant labor.
And the defining characteristic of this shockwave is something the sources call the ripple effect. Let's connect this directly to the listener's wallet.
Okay, let's do it.
Because if someone is frustrated by high grocery prices right now, or the incredibly high cost of buying a home, how does the data connect those specific pain points directly to a drop in immigrant labor?
The data connects those dots directly through the supply side of the economy. Let's look at the housing market first.
Okay, housing crisis.
Research by the Urban Institute and a major article in Fortune highlighted how a crackdown on immigrant workers severely worsened an already critical construction labor shortage.
Because you cannot build affordable housing without construction workers.
You physically cannot. Building a house requires a massive chain of labor. You need framers, roofers, drywall installers, painters, electricians.
And the immigrant labor force is heavily represented in those specific trades.
Extremely heavily. So when mass deportations or massive enforcement surges remove a massive chunk of that specific labor force, construction projects just grind to a halt. Houses take months longer to build.
And when housing supply plummets, but the demand for housing remains steady because people still need a place to live. The cost of existing homes and rent skyrockets for everybody.
Exactly. You are choking the supply.
Wow. And the exact same mechanism applies to the grocery store, doesn't it?
It does. The Guardian mapped out the U.S. food industry, demonstrating an extreme reliance on immigrant labor at literally every single node of the supply chain.
Every node. From the farm workers picking crops in the fields of California,
to the workers in the Midwest meatpacking plants we just talked about, all the way down to the delivery logistics.
So if you remove that labor, the chain breaks at the source.
Crops literally rot in the fields because there is no one to harvest them before they spoil.
Wow.
Meat processing plants have to slow down their lines because they don't have the staff. This creates a massive bottleneck in the food supply chain.
Which means the supply of food hitting the market drops. And again, demand hasn't changed. We still have to eat. So the prices at the register soar for every single consumer.
Everyone pays the price of that missing labor.
But the economic damage isn't just limited to the labor supply side, is it? Because the sources talk about a secondary wave of damage that hits local native-born businesses.
Right. This is the consumer side of the equation. Undocumented immigrants and foreign-born workers are not just workers, you know. They are active consumers.
They spend money.
Exactly. A Brookings report on the 2025 enforcement surge showed the localized impact of sudden mass deportations.
What happens locally?
Well, when you suddenly remove the undocumented workforce from a city, you don't just lose their labor. You immediately lose the billions of dollars in consumer spending that they inject into the local economy every week.
Well, because they stop buying groceries locally. They aren't paying rent, they aren't buying clothes, or paying for car repairs.
Exactly. You are pulling massive amounts of capital out of the local economy overnight. So native-owned businesses suddenly see a massive drop in demand.
Which means job growth actually slows down for native-born workers because the overall demand in the local ecosystem just shrank.
Right. The governor of New York even warned that mass deportations could crush the state's economy simply by pulling out that foundational consumer base.
And just to prove that this demographic and economic reality isn't exclusively an American phenomenon, the sources include some really telling international examples.
Yeah, this is a global mathematical reality.
Le Monde reported recently on France's evolving policies. What's happening there?
Well, France is facing severe demographic decline, an aging population, and persistently low birth rates. So regardless of the very heated political rhetoric there, immigration has emerged as an absolute economic necessity.
Just to keep their pension systems of basic services functioning.
Exactly. They have to have the prime age workers.
And in Asia, Reuters reported that Thailand is actively changing its policies to allow Myanmar refugees to work legally. Why are they doing that?
Thailand is facing severe labor shortages themselves. They realize that letting refugees work legally turns them from a marginalized, aid-dependent population into active taxpayers and contributors to the formal economy.
It's a mathematical reality that supersedes regional politics.
It really is. You can't debate the math.
We've covered an immense amount of ground today. I mean, tracking this ecosystem from the manual labor on the forest floor all the way up to the patent-producing canopy.
We really did.
And the empirical evidence from across the spectrum, from the National Academies to the Federal Reserve to rural case studies, it paints a picture of immigration not as a charity and not as a simple line item cost, but as a fundamental engine of economic dynamism.
It drives the task specialization that protects native wages. It fuels the risk-taking that builds Fortune 500 companies.
It funds the federal budget through massive tax injections.
And it provides the essential care workers keeping an aging society functioning.
So based on all the research we've unpacked today, I'm going to leave you with a final thought to mull over.
Okay.
We are conditioned to think about global power in terms of military might or, you know, the depth of a country's natural resources. But in the 21st century, a nation's position as a global superpower might ultimately be decided by something much simpler.
What's that?
Its demographic pipeline.
Yeah.
Because if economies can only grow and thrive when they have enough people to invent, to build, to care, and to consume, then the ability to attract, retain, and integrate global talent isn't just a fiery political debate.
No, it's not.
It is the ultimate mathematical necessity for a country's survival.
When you look at the long-term data, the math is truly undeniable.
So the next time you hear a debate about the economy, don't look for the static full glass of water. Look for the ecosystem.
Hmm.
Because that messy, dynamic, constantly evolving environment is exactly what keeps the whole thing alive. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We'll catch you next time.